Activist and author Antonia Yuhas wrote in the New York Times in 2007, "Today, more than three-quarters of the world's oil is owned and controlled by governments. It wasn't always this way. Until the early 70s, the Seven Sisters controlled oil. They're now down to four, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP. But ever since they lost their exclusive control of the oil to the governments, the companies have been trying to get it back." Antonia Yuhas joins us in the studio now. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 at the College of Southern Nevada's campus on East Cheyenne. She's written the book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. Antonia, welcome to the program. And you say again that these companies have been trying to get back their exclusive control ever since. So far as you're concerned, that is driving what? Economic policy, foreign policy, and pretty much everything else?
Environmental policy, human rights, public safety, public health, worker safety, who is in charge of the government, how policies are made, climate policy, pretty dominant footprint being laid by this incredibly dominant industry.
First of all, how did the Big Seven, now the Big Four, how did they lose control of oil to government?
The rising up of countries and citizens all across the world in resistance to these companies exercising this dominance we've just been talking about, which they're exercising here over countries all around the world. Citizens rose up and said, actually, we need to control this resource and we need to decide who our government is. Governments were being excessively dominated by the whims of the oil industry. And a very simple term, nationalization, happened all over the world. Countries took control and ownership of their oil, nationalized it, and reduced the amount of oil that the industry owns. Unfortunately, for us, that hasn't changed the capacity of the industry to wield an enormous footprint in terms of utilizing oil as a resource, gasoline as a resource, and the profits they earn from them to dominate policy.
It's been some time since I read it, but I'm thinking back to Daniel Yergin's great book, The Prize, about the oil industry going back to the late 1800s. And he documented in that book in the mid-80s the concept that we saw basically the U.S. and Great Britain agreed to carve up the Middle East and oil supplies in those regions. And over time, certainly, you saw countries such as Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia step up and, as you say, take control of some of that oil. But I still think that there's a sense that many people have is that it's not necessarily an us versus them when it comes to government or business. It's us and them working together.
Well, what's happened in the intervening years since the companies lost control of so much of the oil is that they've found ways to increase the price of oil and the price of gasoline and to capture that profit in ways that have left the oil industry as, hands down, no comparison, the most profitable and wealthiest industry, the industry with the most cash on hand of any industry in the world. It utilizes that utterly unbalanced wealth to influence policy in an utterly unbalanced way. So let me give you just one statistic. ExxonMobil in 2006 earned $40 billion in profits. Profits, just profits, $40 billion with a B. The Sierra Club, which is the largest environmental organization in the United States, its entire annual budget for that year was $36 million with an M. So if we think that we have a balanced debate over how to guide oil policy, energy policy, climate policy, we don't. And that has a lot to do, actually, similarly with the deregulation that you were talking about in the last segment, deregulations that have put an enormous amount of control over markets within this industry, creating imbalance in the way our democracy functions.
Certainly, if you're looking for a template for this, the oil industry and the relationship with government in this country and elsewhere in the world, you could think back to the 1870s, 1880s, and the Gilded Age, and the role of the railroad industry, and much of the documented corruption that we saw, the money in politics, the control of the U.S. House and Senate. Is this a new Gilded Age that we're living in?
Forget the railroad industry. Let's talk about the oil industry. It was Standard Oil that was the dominant oil company for the world, for the country, and it was in resistance to Standard Oil's political power that a mass people's movement emerged, the populist movement, the progressive movement. It, through organizing, brought about the breakup into 34 separate parts of the largest corporation the world had ever known at that time, The reason for the upset was the political influence exercised by Standard Oil. The response was break it up. Well, it's been about 100 years, and in the intervening years, the biggest pieces of Standard Oil have all remerged. So Exxon and Mobil were the two largest post-breakup pieces of Standard Oil. They're now one corporation. Chevron is the product of a merger of Gulf and Texaco and Unocal. That's Chevron. Conoco and Phillips have merged. BP is Amoco and Arco are all part of BP. Shell is several other smaller pieces that it's bought. They've re-coalesced, and they've recreated that political control that Standard Oil exercised 100 years ago.
There's something else that happened about 100 years ago. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that corporations cannot give freely in politics at the federal level, and now the U.S. Supreme Court is reconsidering that decision, and that could pump more money back into the process. How could that change the equation if the court rules that suddenly corporations can give even more freely, not through PACs, but directly to the political process?
Yeah, I think there is a sense that, corporations dominate campaign giving, but they could dominate it so much more than they do right now. They actually give very limited amounts to campaigns because there's a legal limit to how much they can contribute. Where they spend the enormous quantities of money is in the unregulated sector, which is in lobbying. So just another example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is heavily dominated by big oil at this moment, it's the amount of money that it spends on lobbying is twice as much as the next largest presence on Capitol Hill, twice as much. The next largest presence is the American Medical Association. If you look at the expenditures on lobbying of these companies, it's astounding. If you then translated those policy that financial ability to contribute into campaigns, it would be devastating, again, because there just isn't any equal balance, not only between business and public interests and public interest organizations in terms of their financial capacity, but within business. So it used to be that you had, for example, banks and car companies and other industries that financially were in comparison and in competition with the oil industry. The last 2 years has completely changed that. So now we have, for the first time in history, 7 of the 10 largest corporations in the world are oil companies. And financially, the banks aren't competing. The car companies certainly aren't competing. But if you think about other industries that we think might, like insurance or defense or agriculture or illegal activities, none of those industries come even close.
You talk about, and you will talk tonight at 7 at the College of Southern Nevada Cheyenne campus, Antonio Yuhas, as you speak about the tyranny of oil, your book, The Tyranny of Oil. You talk about the role that big business plays and the relationship with government. And certainly we've heard going back to the 1970s, Jimmy Carter pushing for a surcharge on fuel, saying that if we added on a dollar or $2 surcharge per gallon, we could take some of that money and really become energy independent. Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, has pushed that for a number of years as well. Friedman, Carter would argue, I think they would argue very publicly, that the oil industry has shut down any transformation to a green economy and in part has hurt the economy of Southern Nevada that looks to green as potentially a savior.
Southern Nevada, well, Nevada has been hurt in so many ways by the retreat of regulation of this industry that's really taken place. The whole country has suffered. We were moving on a very energy efficient mode throughout the 1970s. That got aggressively shut down in the 1980s by the Reagan administration. We shifted away from investing in clean energy alternatives. We shifted away from investing in public transportation. Literally, the solar panels were taken off of the White House, right? And a shift moved towards deregulation, a shift against the implementation of antitrust policy, allowing these mergers to take place, and a number of changes. And so some of the impacts that impact Nevada are, one, the high price of gasoline in Nevada. One of the reasons why gas is so high here and also high in my home state of California is because you get all of your gasoline from California. My state of California is an oligopoly. We have four companies that control over 80% of the refining market. They're currently being sued for price fixing, for controlling the supply of gasoline, limiting supply to increase the price of gasoline, and those companies control the spigot on gasoline into the state. Those companies have made it so that there are half as many refineries as there were in the mid-1970s in the United States. There's 50,000 fewer gasoline stations than there were, and twice as many cars. Essentially, the independents have all been pushed out. Control is being held in a few hands. They're controlling price, they're controlling supply, and they're trying to control alternatives. But what's so dramatic in the last election is that we, as a public, had that same sort of resurgence that happened 100 years ago, rejected an oil government, and have put in place a government which is at least leaning towards and financially leaning towards pushing us to embrace the green alternatives that the oil industry has been keeping away from us for 30 years.
Are you satisfied with what you've seen from the Obama administration just within the first year?
Satisfied isn't the word I would use.
What is the word you would use?
I would say I am enthused by the change of direction. What we need, however, is for the American public to continue the pressure and the activism that brought Obama into office to make sure that the policies that he's proposing actually get into place, because we're starting to see, unfortunately, all of that business influence, shifting policy promises that Obama made during the election that are not getting put in place today that we very, very, very much need.
Antonio Yuhas, as you hear the debate right now over whether or not the U.S. should send an additional 20,000 to 40,000 troops into Afghanistan, one of the things that doesn't go talked about is this planned pipeline, I believe a natural gas pipeline?
There's natural gas and an oil pipeline.
And an oil pipeline that would tie in with Russia, that would take it to Europe. And how does that factor into the equation as well as to whether or not the U.S. should send in more troops?
Well, I think that fortunately, there is a real debate going on within the Obama administration over what to do about Afghanistan. If we look at both the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, these are wars that the administration inherited from the last. The last administration was incredibly unique in the extent to which it was willing to utilize the U.S. military for a broad a swath of goals, one most certainly of which is control of energy resources. And the way that Afghanistan is discussed among the U.S. military, among General James Jones, who's now the head of the National Security Council, who was previously for 2 years the head of the Institute for 21st Century Energy at the United States Chamber of Commerce, which means he was the major oil lobbying voice within the Chamber of Commerce, arguing for a more direct linkage between national security and energy policy. And the way he referred to Afghanistan and everyone else in that area is as an energy corridor, the corridor through which we get out the oil that's trapped in Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan, where we get the natural gas that's in that region. It's got to get out somehow. It goes out through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Arabian Sea. That's not the only reason why troops were sent there. But if you look at the model of the way that the invasion and occupation has proceeded, it has not focused on the threat, which is the terrorist threat in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Instead, it has focused on a model of occupation that only services a longer-term set of interests around control of energy, which is creating far, far, far more enemies towards the United States, towards our presence, making us less secure. And this is certainly true in Iraq. It's also true in Afghanistan.
What do you say to people who would argue that these are national issues, these are international issues, these aren't local issues?
That shouldn't be concerned to local residents? Well, there's a very, very large military population within this state, which I think is very, very concerned about the use that our sons and daughters are being put towards, their lives, their livelihoods, how they're being utilized. Also, of course, the environment is all of our concerns, and public health is all of our concerns, and the decisions being made in Nevada around using geothermal or wind or solar, as opposed to these mass discussions of excavation out towards the Utah border of a sort of fantasy of big reservoirs of oil, which really don't exist, but to hold on to that land.
I'm talking about the shale that theoretically is in the ground.
There's two discussions. One's around shale that might be out there. The other is around a potential reservoir that might be out there, neither of which have any geological support, but could be utilized. The myth could be used to keep that land from being preserved and used for alternative energy instead of being held on for oil.
We talked earlier, Antonio Yuhas, about the breakup of Standard Oil about 100 years ago, 1906, 1907, by the Roosevelt administration. And certainly, I believe it was the 1920s, 1930s, actually, where the studio system was broken up in this country, where it went from top to bottom. We make the film, and then we distribute it through our own movie theaters. Why haven't federal regulators been aggressive about breaking up the hold of the oil industry when it comes to not just pulling it out of the ground, refining it, but also distributing it through gas stations?
Yeah, the death of the independent gas station has been a huge transformation in the United States. Why hasn't it happened? This industry has a wealth and an influence that only has a few comparisons, but we're seeing this change of there used to be an approach to antitrust in the United States through the 60s, through the 70s, which was that the size of an industry, we have a public policy commitment to making sure that there are other interests such as diversity in the economy, democracy, equality within the economy that our antitrust policy is supposed to look out for. That was abandoned in the 80s. It was abandoned in the 90s. It's still been abandoned. And we've seen mass conglomeration within the banking sector, within the oil sector, within entertainment, within the media that has had a detrimental effect on democracy, has had a detrimental effect on economic equality. It's not just this sector that it's happening to. It's a problem that we have to address, and it's getting worse because what's happened as a result of the economic crisis? Increased consolidation within the banking sector in particular, increased consolidation in the insurance sector, and we're looking at the potential of more mergers within the oil sector, and it is a path that the United States followed 100 years ago. It was very detrimental 100 years ago, but we responded, we organized, we challenged it, we won, we can do it again.
And I should note that the breakup of the movie industry came in the 1940s and the studio system along with the distribution system. Very quickly, Antonio Yuhas, I just want to ask you, because certainly as you look going forward and you look at oil industry in this country, can you truly see a day where ExxonMobil or the other big giants, Chevron, Shell, BP, aren't dominating some aspect of the energy narrative in this country or on this planet?
I think what we're hopefully moving towards is a day in which the oil industry behaves better as an oil industry. It's more regulated so that it is cleaner, safer, more humane in its operations. And we better regulate it because we're going to use oil for a long time and these companies will be around for a long time. But we have to decrease the amount of political influence they're able to exercise so that we see a day in which the alternatives are able to dominate.
We only have 30 seconds left. How do you decrease it? Because certainly the Supreme Court ruled in the 1960s that on an individual level, the campaign donations are a reflection of free speech. You could rule on a corporate level any day now that it's free speech for corporations. So how do you reduce their clout within either context?
Public organizing is the only way. So they have money. We have votes. We vote with numbers. We vote with our presence. They try to control political power through money. It is only through organizing. It is only through outreach. It is only for people actually speaking up and demanding change among policymakers that change happens.
The name of the book, The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. The author is Antonio Yuhas. She's speaking tonight at 7 on the Cheyenne campus of the College of Southern Nevada. And Antonio, thanks so much. Come back soon.
Thanks for having me. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us today. Our producers are Ian Mulchrist and Lee Hernandez. Rich Copeland, Ronald Corso are our technical directors. Daniel Branton's our web guru. Our interns are Cresha Page and Jessica Preuss, and I'm Dave Burns. For information about future programs, go to KNPR.org and register for SON First.